frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on December 17th, 2017, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Rachel and Nate join me to talk about the problem of water utility privatization and the Sanders-Warren recovery plan for Puerto Rico and ongoing recovery problems there. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio again this week is Nate. Hey, Nate.
Great to be here, Bill.
And joining us on the line from Idaho is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Nice to be here.
So the first topic we are covering this week is about water privatization, specifically mainly in the United States we'll be talking about. Basically, public water supplies. We're not talking about water rights issues so much as like the actual infrastructure and water utilities being privatized. I guess, Rachel, we'll start with you as a jumping off point. You had brought this as a potential topic because of the fact that there is privatized water in your area in Idaho. Tell us a little bit more about that and some of the problems that have arisen as a result.
So Boise is in a public-private partnership with Suez North America, which it turns out they operate 90 municipal water and wastewater systems in the U.S., and they own and operate 16 water and wastewater utilities. So Boise is one of them. And it I've only been paying into the system as a homeowner for the past 3 years, so I haven't really noticed what the rate comparatively to like my hometown in Caldwell, Idaho is, but it definitely has its disadvantages. So in about 5 years ago, 80 residents of a West Boise neighborhood got sick over Memorial Day weekend because Campylobacter, which is a nasty waterborne bacteria that causes gastrointestinal distress, got into the drinking water from irrigation water. So apparently an empty house that was for sale in a neighborhood had a device called a backflow preventer, but it failed to keep irrigation water out of the drinking water system, and the whole neighborhood got sick. So apparently United Water, which is what Suez Water used to be called, they kind of inspected and they guessed something was wrong, but because it was over Memorial Day weekend, it took them 5 calendar days to actually get someone up in that neighborhood to see what exactly was happening. So there was like definitely a delayed response time, a really poor customer service. And the spokesman said, we did everything that was possible to do what we could when we knew what the problem was. But it took them from a Thursday to a Tuesday to figure out like stuff was happening and that they needed to fix it. So there really is an incentive for United Water or Suez to really provide good customer service, because they say they're not ultimately responsible for keeping irrigation water out of the drinking water system. So they get to kind of pass the buck onto the customers to have the proper backflow device on their system and get it tested. So even though this house was vacant, apparently it was the neighborhood's fault for not maintaining their devices in their home. So it's just, a really good way to pass responsibility off onto the consumer. And apparently the Idaho DEQ agreed with United Water and said, yeah, they did all they could. So it seems pretty shady and just not very good service to the public.
Well, this is a great, as I said, jumping off point for this segment, partly because it's the perfect story for Rachel to have a microbiology disease outbreak happening in Idaho in the middle of a story about privatization of public assets. That's, you know, we couldn't ask for a better intersection of your professional and non-professional interests. But as you said, Suez is the company that is the private operator there. And they have, as you mentioned, contracts all over the United States in, you know, 90 or so locations. They're also a giant global firm based in France with huge operations all over the world. We'll be talking about some of those later, but we're talking like, you know, there's operations in Europe, there's operations in Indonesia, there's operations in the United States. And so this is really a pretty sort of globe-spanning issue. And, you know, if you even look up on Wikipedia, I was looking up earlier to see, you know, what do they say on the article for Suez Environnement, which is the subsidiary that now has their water division. And there's almost nothing about them on the page, even though they're this huge company with operations all over the place. Like most other comparable type of companies, I think, would have more info, but this isn't something that people necessarily focus on as much. So it's good to shine a little bit more of a light on this, and that's what we wanted to do today. Again, there's a lot of places around the United States that have had this privatization happen. And there's a number of different ways that this happens, which Nate is going to walk us through some of them. There's like just normal for-profit utilities operating the water. There's private equity has gotten in on this game. And a lot of this is leading to whether it's disease outbreaks like that or mismanagement of other things or just huge rate increases, things like that, that, you know, are shocking to the customers and not necessarily based on sound policy, or just tapping into water supplies that they shouldn't tap into. There's a lot going on here. Nate, where do we move on this topic from this point?
Yeah, so there was an interesting article in the New York Times from last year focusing on one city of Bayonne, New Jersey, although as we were just talking about, this affects a lot of New Jersey, especially because it has one of the highest concentration of water privatization in the country. But this article sort of lays out how this sort of blue-collar port city back in 2012 cut a deal with a Wall Street investment firm to manage its municipal waterworks. And basically, there were these really old pipes that, you know, needed to be replaced, and they hadn't been upgraded or anything. Going back actually to the Coolidge administration, that was a long time ago. So there was an investment firm came in, and they have replaced all the pipes with these new ones. But unfortunately, the water bill has jumped pretty significantly. People report paying quarterly water bills almost $500. Another resident's water bill jumped 5%, despite the household having used 11% less water. And then sort of the article then goes in how a lot of these private equity firms come in and basically say, we have the capital to actually invest, and here's what we're going to set up, and we're going to upgrade your water pipes, but you have to pay us a little bit more. And a lot of these firms, they earn returns anywhere 8 to 18%, which is more than what a regular for-profit water company usually gets. And oftentimes they flip their investments around. So I guess apparently the venture capital firm is shopping its 90% stake in the Bayonne venture, which is partnership with Suez, as we've talked about. And also water rates, since the deal was done, water rates in Bayonne have risen nearly 28%. And this is creating some pretty serious stress on the taxpayers, which to their credit, Suez admits, they don't say they're going to do anything about it, but they admit that, oh yes, we understand these increases create stress for ratepayers. And there's been talk about how people are considering moving out of the town. There are further like liens on people's houses, and it's contributing to foreclosures and things like that, because just people's water bills are going up and they can't really deal with that. So I think that's a pretty significant issue. And there's also a couple other towns recently in New Jersey that where water privatization went on the ballot. So in Long Hill and High Bridge, they both voted to keep their systems public. One, West Milford, voted to privatize because they were being told that it will cost $70 million to fix the town's water system, and they don't have that kind of money, and they sold their water to Suez. So that's what's going on there.
Earlier, you noted that this article kind of highlighted, you know, oh, these pipelines for the water supply haven't been replaced since the Coolidge administration, and that's not something that's unique to just that specific community in New Jersey. This is a sort of, I mean, obviously there was a lot of discussions about water pipeline issues around Flint, Michigan, but more broadly across the country, a lot of water systems, public water systems, have pipes that have not been replaced fully since the 1920s, that'd be the Coolidge administration, or even the decade prior to that. That timeline basically corresponds in many of, not all, but many of these communities with the initial push that would subsequently be dubbed sewer socialism, or, you know, the sort of progressive version of that in some places where there wasn't as strong of a socialist tendency, but basically a bunch of people saying around the, you know, turn of the last century and the early, you know, the first 15 or so years of the 20th century, hey, it's the job of the government to provide a public water supply that's clean and safe and delivered to every, you know, building in this city, that sort of thing. And they would install these pipes, the government would install these pipes, and that's where a lot of the public utilities came in. Or, in some cases, they already had a private system that was really not working, and the socialists or the progressives, depending on the location, pushed the government to take over, you know, socialize that and bring that into public control. And so if they did have a pre-existing system at that point, it got overhauled and replaced then, and then that's why it didn't get replaced since then. And one of the things that I think is important to note about that is not just abstractly like, oh, that was a really long time ago, or, oh, let's go back to this successful phase, although I think we should. But it's also that on the one hand, the companies, when they make this excuse of like, oh, we had to jack up the rates dramatically or something because of these huge repairs that we had to do, that's partly true, right? That these systems have been neglected and the repairs have been pushed off and pushed off and pushed off so long that whoever is doing it, whether it's the city or a private company, is going to have to make huge overhauls to the system and replace this. There's a lot of leaks in these older systems, as well as potential health issues and contamination issues and things like that.
Yeah, lead contamination, I think, has been reported in many, many places beyond just Flint. So
right. And a lot of that has to do with how old this infrastructure, water infrastructure is, and that people kept on pushing off the changes and the upgrades to the system. You know, on the one hand, they are partly correct when they're saying that they are having to raise the rates to pay for these costs, et cetera, because it's expensive. Like, that's partly true. Obviously, there's also a component here that if it's taken over by a private equity firm as opposed to even just a normal for-profit company, they really are looking to make a lot of profit off of this. They need to get some returns pretty quickly. So that's a huge incentive to really jack up the rates. And if you're a normal for-profit company, like, our standard argument, as we've talked about many times here on Arsenal for Democracy, is why would you put it in private hands where they're going to have to make a profit if it's a for-profit operation, when you could just take that money that you would be making as a quote-unquote profit and put it into further investments elsewhere in the system? There's no real reason to be diverting it out to, you know, whichever company, Suez or any of these other companies, or a private equity firm of any type. It doesn't need to be going that way. But I think that a lot of these, you know, there are certainly some people who are just pushing this at the municipal level because they love the free market. You know, they're either some sort of libertarian or conservative, or they're, you know, a neoliberal Democrat who thinks that the, you know, market solutions to these public problems are better. That's true. There are some people who are pushing this for ideological reasons. But I also would suspect that in many cases, a lot of these municipal leaders are pushing this simply as a way to get out of having to raise taxes. And that's setting aside the issue of water rates themselves from a public policy standpoint if you're publicly operating a water supply. If you are going to undertake a huge renovation and overhaul of 1920s era pipes in a very large area, what, you know, of your suburb or major city or something like that, that's going to cost a lot of money, and it's probably going to have to involve, like, in some places, a tax override or a special ballot measure or something like that. It's going to take more than just the water rates to pay for it. And again, partly that's because of how long they have delayed these changes. As with any type of infrastructure, they just keep pushing it off and pushing it off, and the costs add up and add up and add up, especially when you're not replacing it piece by piece. You're trying to do a huge overhaul in a short amount of time once it finally becomes so dire that you can't keep delaying it. So instead of taking the political heat for doing these taxes, they put it on the ballot or vote it through at city council or whatever to privatize it, knowing that the company is going to have to dramatically increase the cost to customers in order to pay for the infrastructure changes. But then that's on the private company rather than on the city politicians, and they don't have to raise taxes or be seen to raise taxes. Ultimately, though, the solution to that is going to have to be that a lot of folks are going to have to start getting comfortable with explaining to voters what the taxes pay for. They need to say, this is a specific thing we need the money for. If we do not have this money, our water system will fall apart. And it's not an option to just privatize it. We need this to be in public control. We need to do it publicly. And, you know, we're going to have to raise some taxes in order to not have to do dramatic rate increases. But until a lot of these politicians, especially in the suburbs, are willing to talk about why taxes matter and campaign in favor of certain tax increases, there's going to be a serious problem. The other thing, though, of course, is the rates themselves. You know, there are public policy cases. You know, Nate, I don't know if you wanted to talk a little bit about that, but the in some cases, you do have to raise the rates. I mean, there's environmental factors there. There's just the question of pricing the water responsibly so, you know, people aren't overusing it, watering all their lawns and everything. So that is a legitimate thing in some cases, but there's obviously a balancing act there.
Yeah, I think that's fairly significant. Obviously, it's sort of a case-by-case basis. And when you're seeing rates go up by like 28% or whatever, clearly there's some issue. This is not just sort of the normal market fluctuating based on demand, supply, things like that. I also wanted to mention, because you talked about Indonesia earlier and how Suez, Rachel's friends there, are also very much involved in Jakarta, because apparently after Suharto, at the waning years of his dictatorship, they privatized all of Jakarta's water, including to Suez as one of two companies. And there was a recent Indonesian Supreme Court ruling where basically the cooperation agreement has had a real and extraordinary impact on society in a negative respect. Piped water services can only be accessed by half the population in Indonesia. Citizens must pay for clean water at very high rates, but with very poor water quality and quantity. Basically saying people are drinking bottled water and then bathing in the polluted public wells. So that's part of, and so they're going to be looking to re-municipalize, put in public hands. And this is sort of part of a global trend where I think over 200 cities in over 35 countries, including places like Paris, have re-municipalized previously privatized water just because they're seeing the effects and they're not really liking it. There, I think there was a couple years back, there was a large gathering in Barcelona, which I think is another one of these cities, Paris, Berlin, as yeah, Jakarta. So I think this is a pretty worldwide trend. And luckily, our friends at Suez are very much involved in this whole thing. So
I did like that one of the companies in Indonesia just so happened to be the general's son, you know, as he's on the way out the door in the late 1990s from the regime in Indonesia, just coincidentally gives this huge water contract to his son's company. And as the court said, that's really hurting a lot of Indonesians. Rachel, we've been talking about a lot of different angles here, and there's much more that we could talk about. What is something that you wanted to drill down a little bit more into on one of these angles?
Well, as it says in this article about Jakarta, across the world, cities keep running into the same problems with these public-private partnerships: price discrimination, insufficient infrastructure investments, and environmental risks. So I think we in North America have a few more protections in place, but cities like Jakarta or Johannesburg or Buenos Aires don't have these protections in place. So these multinational companies can just kind of run rampant and steal. So it looks like during the Suharto regime, the dictator, whose children and cronies have allegedly stolen about $15 billion. So now Jakarta and Indonesia are just stuck, and they don't know how to get their country back from and recover from this looting. So it's really important to look globally and see what these corporations are doing.
Yeah, and I'm seeing also Suez boss sees water becoming more valuable than oil, basically saying that in the future, you know, we're going to have to increasingly invest in this water market, and basically saying that you could see it probably becoming a more valuable commodity than oil in the future. It's also important to note that industries account for a fifth of global water use compared with 5% for humans. So a lot of these large corporations are using things like for wastewater recycling or desalination plants or things like that. And also, I'm just sort of thinking a little farther into the future, as global warming ramps up, water will become an increasingly scarce resource, and probably there'll be water wars or competition for water as a resource. So I think that's sort of pointing towards the future there.
Also worth noting that Suez, the water company subsidiary, is largely owned by a larger energy firm. They used to be part of a sort of huge conglomerate operation that does a lot of stuff involving natural gas and other sort of conventional fossil fuel energy stuff, and electrical utilities, electricity utilities, things like that. So for them to be saying like, oh, you know, water is the new oil, like, to some degree, they know what they're talking about. That's not the terms that I would probably put it in, but like from their perspective, they're going to view it in the same sort of rapacious way that these oil companies view it in, because their parent company is one of these fossil fuel companies. Now, of course, you know, in the United States, especially in the Western United States, water use in general is a pretty hot button issue. That's beyond the scope of this episode to talk about water rights issues in general. But obviously, there is a conversation to be had about the broader sort of public versus private way we look at water itself, the resource rather than the utilities, and that having it in sort of public custodianship is probably necessary in many cases to adequately and fairly distribute it, because if it's entirely based on your ability to buy it, then that creates various problems. And I'm sure that Idaho has had its fair share of controversies over water usage in the way that most of the Mountain West states have. California, though, is another thing that we wanted to talk about, at least in passing, because some of these water, these privately owned and operated water utilities, they don't just, you know, misappropriate and misuse water for some of the other issues that come up in the Mountain West, but they try to get more water from, you know, potentially controversial and damaging places. Nate, did you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, there's an article from late November in the AP basically describing how there's a plan to sue the Trump administration because of plans to pump water out from the Mojave to sell it to Southern California cities and counties. And the U.S. Bureau of Land Management is allowing Cadiz Inc. To build a 43-mile pipeline to transfer the water from its desert wells into Colorado River Aqueduct to sell it to water districts. I guess was blocked under the Obama administration, and the Trump administration put it on a priority infrastructure list, and it would go right through the Mojave Trails National Monument. So this is more pipeline issues going through various lands that perhaps that
I think it's indigenous lands,
yeah,
there too.
Exactly. So,
and of course, if you start pumping out the underlying water in a desert, people often don't think of deserts as having water, but underneath a lot of them, there is often water in the soil and sand and everything. That's going to destabilize that desert, you know, ecologically, and also potentially just make it so that it completely dries out at the ground level and the dust starts blowing around. That has happened in many other places around the world. If you take out the groundwater at a pretty fast clip from a desert, then anything that was sort of stabilizing the sand and soil in place is gone. And then, you know, it's dry sand instead of wet sand, and that starts blowing around. So that's another potential concern there. But I think like that's another concern, right? It's that these private water utility companies, even if they're literally just a water utility company, not a water sort of ownership company that's distributing it to, you know, various clients, factories or, you know, chip manufacturers. That's been an issue in some of the Southwest, is like computer chip makers need a lot of water through their processing plants. Even just looking at the water utilities themselves that are just supplying like normal consumer water supply, they sometimes even themselves have an incentive to start, you know, trying to go get water from other locations that they probably shouldn't be getting that water from, or getting it at an unsustainable rate. And so that's like a pretty valid concern, I think, that a lot of people have with the privatization. Obviously, you can have the public sector making pretty bad decisions too regarding resources like water. That's certainly something that's happened in the past. But in general, like, if you at least have it in public hands, you can start having that conversation about, well, from a public policy standpoint, balancing all factors that the public sector has to answer to, what is the best way of handling and distributing these resources? Whereas a private company tends not to be so concerned with equitable and fair and responsible distribution of resources. And of course, that leads again to that issue that we'll maybe talk about some other time regarding rate hikes to manage water usage a bit better, golf courses, excessive lawns, things like that. These are all sort of other concerns as well in this general realm, although slightly outside the scope of what we're talking about narrowly today. Rachel, before we go to the next segment, what are your closing thoughts on this water privatization topic as someone who's experiencing it firsthand?
Well, I think regardless of whether you have a public operated utility or a private public partnership operated utility, I think maybe you should start looking at your water rates. And if they are low, maybe start to look at why they may be artificially lowered, and really start to question your infrastructure and what needs to be done to update that infrastructure, whether it comes from the public sector in raised taxes or raised rates, and just be more cognizant, because I've looked at my water bill every 2 months and I see the Suez, but I never really thought that much past it. I was kind of suspicious that it was a French-owned company, but I think we just need to be more curious about where our water is coming from and who's providing it to our homes.
Nate, your closing thoughts on this?
Yeah, I just want to close with mentioning a potential success story near Boise in Missoula, Montana. They recently bought out their water system from a private company back in June, and they're planning about $30 million in investments over the next 5 years, and they want to not raise water rates while they're doing it. So that's pretty small city, but that's a potential model to look forward to. Also, it is, it's very frustrating when you're like speaking with, say, libertarians or people that generally believe that it's more efficient to have private water systems and things like that, and they're just not really engaging with, okay, rates are going up and their people's concerns aren't really being listened to, and oftentimes it's not a free market. It's private equity firms and like the sons of Suharto's dictatorship, taking control of a lot of these water companies. It's not necessarily some magical free market where everything's going to work out because
efficiency.
Yeah, exactly. So
as usual, if you go to arsenalfordemocracy.com, when this episode is released, there will be all of the links that we've talked about, all the different articles. We'll also have some links to some information about some like previews about some documentaries on this topic. Many places in Europe have also had privatized water systems, and there's a movement that is pushing to get those re-socialized again back into the public sector. So we'll have all of these links up at arsenalfordemocracy.com when this episode is released, so that you can check out more info about that. Coming up in the next segment, we'll be talking about Puerto Rico. Please stick around from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. We'll be right back. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate, and on the line with me from Idaho is Rachel. We're going to be talking now about Puerto Rico. This is something that we've been kind of internally on the team talking about when we were going to talk about Puerto Rico. But you know, aside from the hurricane stuff itself, but there is a lot that you can potentially cover, and some of it we don't necessarily feel that qualified to cover. None of us are from Puerto Rico or know a whole lot about some of the internal stuff in Puerto Rico. In general, like, I would like to see them become a state, but there are people who have valid reasons for not wanting that, and then there, you know, are also people who would want independence. We wanted to talk about sort of some of the competing proposals for how to handle the recovery and aftermath in Puerto Rico. Most of the Republican proposals, you will not be surprised to hear, are terrible for Puerto Rico. They generally favored, like, instead of giving direct aid, you know, in grants like they did to locations in Florida or Texas for the other hurricanes, the Congress approved even more loans to the already sort of bankrupted government of Puerto Rico because they love issuing more debt that then can be, you know, eventually acquired by the debt vultures from Wall Street that keep on circling anytime Puerto Rico's in distress. There's also been the Whitefish Energy controversy that we talked about a little bit in passing, where this totally unqualified company got a sweetheart deal through Ryan Zinke, the Interior Secretary. I would consider that to be like a teapot dome level scandal at the Interior Department, just open corruption for one of his close friends and donors. But because of everything else that's going on, that hasn't really been getting that much attention. But they were supposed to replace the energy system, and they got this really aggressively unaccountable contract, and fortunately that was subsequently revoked. But that was a real mess, and there's, as Nate will talk a little bit about, there's still some problems with the just getting the electricity grid back up and running. It's going to take much longer than it should. There was all these controversies over the Jones Act, which I don't want to get too much into that because that's related to like shipping laws and regulations and stuff, and not really my area of expertise. But there's been a lot going on. There's also the scandal involving manipulating the death counts. There were a lot of people who didn't die directly because of the hurricane, like a tree didn't fall on them directly or something like that. But, you know, the lack of electricity led to their death, or the exposure to the elements subsequently led to their death, or disease or whatever. All these things, thousands of people have likely died as a result of this, but are not being counted in the official toll of the hurricane or any of the hurricanes that hit Puerto Rico. The latest Republican proposal was a sort of pretty dramatically mercantilist colonial policy that was rolled out. There was an article in the New York Times on December 16th about this. This was part of the tax reform bill, so to speak, that's going through Congress right now. They decided that they were going to add a tax in Puerto Rico, treat it as a foreign country for the purposes of intellectual property income. There would be a 12.5% tax on income related to intellectual property in Puerto Rico. And the government of Puerto Rico is very upset about this. They say it's going to endanger industries and thousands of jobs in the island. But also it's just like very problematic from an overall standpoint that you're treating this commonwealth that you already aren't really helping out with recovery, even though that's part of the United States. You're then you're making it even worse by literally treating them as if they're this extractive colony. I mean, the Times keeps referring to it as treating them like a foreign country, but really it's even less like that. It's more like the relationship, you know, in the 1700s between a European power and its colony in the Americas, where you have to trade with the mothership country, so to speak, and you have to do it on their terms, and there's a lot of expensive taxes. So not really clear on where they're going with this, but interesting that this huge tax cut bill found time to impose a big new tax on Puerto Rico at one of its most vulnerable points. So like I said, all kinds of things have been happening, and the Republican plans have been just a total disaster. But let's talk about one of the counter proposals, the Sanders-Warren plan. There are a number of things involving debt, reconstruction, energy, things like that. Nate, walk us through what are the basics of this plan from Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, so I think a couple weeks ago they did sort of a rollout, did a whole Facebook live streaming event there with Warren, Sanders, some other Democratic senators like Richard Blumenthal from Connecticut. And the plan was fairly well received by San Juan Mayor Carmen Cruz, who was, of course, feuding with President Trump a little earlier, or he was more feuding with her. So it's about $146 billion recovery package. and some people have dubbed it sort of a Marshall Plan for Puerto Rico, but it would break down with about $62 billion to the territory to help pay off the debts, $51 billion for economic development, and another $27 for infrastructure. And currently, many people, of course, struggling with no electricity, having trouble getting drinking water. A lot of people have already left Puerto Rico. And I guess Trump has requested about $29 billion for Puerto Rico. For Puerto Rico, Florida, and Texas combined. So spreading it out is probably going to leave Puerto Rico with very, very little.
And remember briefly here for context, Puerto Rico has about the same population as Oregon and, you know, had at one point like 95% blackout. And how long did you say it was going to take them to get their grid back online?
I think I heard one thing mentioning like potentially to like March or something like that. I'm looking at an article talking about how union leaders representing the Puerto Rico power company workers have been very critical of local and federal officials as the territory missed a deadline recently to get back 95% of power, and they're only at 64% of power generation now. This is a couple days ago AP article. They're recycling resources, using money out of their own pockets, and 9 of Puerto Rico's 78 municipalities remain completely without power. And thousands of businesses have closed and things like that. So,
yeah, a real disaster situation and something that's not only preventable in the first place, but could have been fixed much more quickly. And again, they keep lumping them in some of the time with the rest of the states when they just want to not spend that much money. And then they completely leave it out or treat it totally differently for these other things like tax and debt related policies. Let's talk a little bit more about the debt, though. Nate, how much was the figure that this Marshall Plan sort of was proposing for debt relief itself, not just aid to reconstruction?
I think it was $62 billion for the territory to help pay off its debts, and I believe its debt is actually higher than that, so it may not completely get rid of the debt here. But
at least it's in the right direction of cancellation, even if it's only partial. I would support full cancellation for Puerto Rico's debt, no question. I supported that before we even got into this hurricane situation. And that's something that Jonathan Cohn has talked a lot about, the PROMESA legislation that was sort of emergency management and debt restructuring for Puerto Rico that was forced on them with austerity policies by the U.S. Congress. Led to a lot of privatizations in the run-up to the hurricane that subsequently probably made a lot of things worse and did lead to these debt vulture situations, as we talked about and as Elizabeth Warren has been talking a lot about. And she's saying not one penny of this debt should be going to pay off these Wall Street guys who didn't even issue the debt in the first place. They just bought it up at, you know, a lower value, which is the traditional operation mode of Wall Street dating back to the late 1700s with the United States debt. I mean, I'm sure they were doing it before then, too. But, you know, in the United States, when the Constitution was being adopted, a lot of that, the provisions were like, you know, that these debt vultures had purchased somebody else's debt repayment obligations and then demanded the full face value, even though they paid pennies on the dollar for it. And they do that in Argentina and Greece and other places. But they're definitely doing it in Puerto Rico as well. And Elizabeth Warren arguing, no, we shouldn't be doing that at all. But I would definitely favor complete cancellation. Rachel, what jumped out at you about this proposal here?
So the bill, as you said, put $13 billion into rebuilding the electrical grids, and it explicitly prohibits public infrastructure receiving federal aid, such as the grid, from being transferred to private ownership. So we were talking earlier during the break about how corporations have used and governments have used these natural disasters as a shock doctrine to just kind of start privatizing everything. This would put up a wall against that, which I think is very important because we've been talking over the past few months about how much worse the private sector is at delivering services to homes and businesses. So I think that really jumped out at me. And also it sets aside $428 million in grants for homeowners and cities for solar panels and microturbines, and more than $40 million for grants to improve home energy efficiency. So it's attacking the climate change issue at multiple levels, updating the grid so it's better able to withstand these more ferocious hurricanes, which are not going to abate anytime soon because climate change is destabilizing this area in particular and worsening the hurricanes that are hitting it. So I think it's very important to not just rebuild the infrastructure, but definitely improve it, make it better able to withstand these natural disasters and prepare the people for what's coming up in the next few decades.
Bernie Sanders noted in particular that the island imports a lot of fossil fuels at the moment and has a very centralized power generation system and grid. Mm-hmm. And so part of the impetus, you know, not just fighting climate change, but just making the grid more robust in general is to move away from fossil fuels toward a decentralized local generation of renewable energy all across the island, which also probably helps in terms of making sure that if part of it goes down, that it doesn't mean the whole grid goes down. Nate?
Right. Yeah, I'm reading an article here in Scientific American talking about potentially trying to use microgrids, which are sort of networks of generators and storage devices and equipment that can route electricity to homes and also interface with renewable energy and, you know, solar, wind, things like that, in order to, as you said, sort of keep the system very localized and sort of decentralized, but in a way that could potentially also bring in the wind power and things like that.
So I think that, you know, between the debt cancellation, the reconstruction aid, and the sort of renewable energy push, I think there's a lot to love in this counter proposal. Of course, no real chance of it going anywhere, it seems like, unfortunately. But, you know, I think that it's important to be offering these counter proposals. And I hope that eventually the Democrats will start pushing more for statehood for Puerto Rico. There's also sort of a misconception that it would, you know, automatically be this Democratic stronghold if it became a state. I mean, it could potentially in federal elections. It's hard to say, but at the moment, you know, they've got a sort of Republican as their representative to Congress. There are various Republican leaders in the state government in Puerto Rico. They do elect plenty of Republicans. Now, some of that politics might change if it were a state rather than some of the internal politics that are there at the moment. And also, a lot of the people who push for statehood are the Republican affiliates in Puerto Rico, so they might not necessarily be pushing in concert with the mainline Democratic Party, but I think that the National Democratic Party should be pushing for this just as a matter of fairness in general, whether or not it's going to elect Democrats or Republicans, although certainly I think we would have a good shot at winning that. I think the Republicans at the federal level have made very clear that they're not really interested in a 95% Spanish-speaking state being introduced to the union. I think a lot of them would be deeply uncomfortable with that above and beyond the sort of discomfort they have with the colonial relationship at the moment and the ability of Puerto Ricans to come to the United States freely because they are already Americans. But, you know, this electricity stuff, I mean, like Rachel said, it has been sort of emblematic of a lot of the problems in general, you know, that are going to keep mounting as the climate change situation worsens, and that they're going to keep trying to push these privatizations in response to both debt and climate disasters for public utilities and operations. But also, again, to circle back to that Whitefish Energy problem with the Interior Department secretary securing this deal to, quote unquote, repair the grid. I mean, that's sort of a bigger picture issue, too, where you get a lot of these companies that are sort of like middle operators that have no particular experience in repairing the thing that they've been hired to do or performing the temporary government function that they've been hired to do through this outsourcing process. Usually they just turn around and hire contractors, subcontractors rather, who are willing to do it at a lower rate than the other people who were bidding, but, you know, have the actual experience, because, you know, a couple of middle manager guys in Montana don't have any particular experience with, certainly not if there's only two of them, with large scale grid repair for a population the size of Oregon. It's just not accurate. And unfortunately, that contract did get canceled subsequently, but it does speak to this larger need to prevent not just the private operation of grids in general, but also like how we deal with emergency responses to crises like this, whether it's the electricity system or something completely different. Like, it's very important to have provisions in place that prevent this outsourcing process. And as many people pointed out, in the mainland United States, if you have a disaster with the electrical grid, like a hurricane comes through or a tornado or whatever, in many places, those are private utilities and they have their own workers, linemen, who can go and make these repairs. If they don't have enough, which in many cases they wouldn't, if there's, you know, a huge ice storm or a huge hurricane, what happens then is that they all have agreements with the other utility companies from all over the region or the entire rest of the country. And suddenly you have linemen showing up, you know, to the Northeast from Virginia or wherever to repair after an ice storm. Or you have guys from Massachusetts going down to Florida to make repairs to the electrical grid when there's a hurricane. This is there's mutual practices in place, sort of like when a fire department sends fire trucks to a neighboring town to help out with a really particularly large fire, or just to provide extra coverage in case some, you know, other incidents happen while the main force is responding to one particular fire. There are ways of doing this, even within the private sector, that are not being used in Puerto Rico. And I think what we're going to see increasingly is anywhere that there's an opportunity to go in this outsourcing direction, rather than employing the existing tactics for emergency management, they're going to start using that as part of this climate shock doctrine stuff. The flip side of which, as we've argued previously on the show, is that we need to start thinking about the climate equivalent of austerity, but in the other direction, which is taking preemptive moves outside of a disaster context to prevent these abuses from happening and to take significant action against the companies that are responsible for either the global warming itself or the total lack of preparedness for dealing with this when these disasters hit. Rachel, anything else that you wanted to talk about on the Puerto Rico topic?
Like you said, we need to definitely be proactive because we've seen what austerity measures do to these regions, such as Puerto Rico or Greece or Spain. So we need to have, like you said, these structures in place to just kind of push back against that before it even rears its ugly head.
Nate, your closing thoughts on this Puerto Rico proposal or any of the other Puerto Rico-related topics that have come up?
Yeah, I think obviously it's critically important that we continue to invest because, as we've seen, the island is probably going to continue to get hit. There are also portions, I believe, in this bill that deal with the Virgin Islands, which we saw get completely wrecked during these hurricanes. And, of course,
that gets even less attention than Puerto Rico.
And also, I think some various islands that are still protectorates or colonies of, say, Britain and France, they're also heavily affected. So we probably should look into those as well. But just in general, I think the Caribbean is pretty fascinating from a colonialism standpoint, by which you have all of these different European colonial powers scrambling to grab all these different islands. I think the U.S. got the Virgin Islands from the Danish way back.
Part of a deal during World War One.
Yeah, so I think this should be a wake-up call for everyone to sort of examine the colonial history and the legacy of such to discover the reasons why the U.S. even controls Puerto Rico in the first place. It's not even like it's close off, you know, the coast of the U.S. It's pretty far out there. So I think we really need to look at the history behind all of this and what we can do to change that going forward. So,
some overdue reevaluation. Yeah.
I would also want to add that there's a number of activists that have gone down and actually participated in the recovery operations down there in Puerto Rico. So obviously it's important to recognize that work that's being done. And of course, everyone trying to deal with the situation down there in Puerto Rico because they live there and they're, you know, trying to deal with all of this, you know, various whitefish shenanigans and things like that, not having power months after the fact. So I think it's important to recognize their struggle as well.
Also, just sort of big picture, but not getting into the details here. You know, I'd encourage folks to check out the Off Fossil Fuels for a Better Future Act that was introduced by Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard from Hawaii. That is a specific setting a target. It's a, you know, rather than dealing with like carbon pricing or cap and trade or whatever, it just sets a hard target that says by 2027, 10 years from now, the U.S. needs to be off fossil fuels 80% of the way, and then by 2035, 18 years from now, needs to be 100% off. And that's one of the most aggressive ones that's out there in Congress right now. It's also one of the only proposals that I've seen that significantly deals with actually trying to halt climate change. Probably not fix it at this point, but it's damage control and mitigating the extent to which the catastrophe unfolds by dealing with it pretty sharply at this point. So I'd encourage folks to check out that legislation as well. As mentioned earlier in the episode, you can find links to the various articles discussed today on the website. That's something that we pretty much put up every episode if there was a bunch of articles. So arsenalfordemocracy.com, there's a radio section, there's an individual post for each radio episode, and so you can find a list of the links that we talked about today. As a reminder, so this is the December 19th episode. Then we are going to be off for 2 weeks. There will be no episodes for the Christmas and New Year's break. And then we should be back around January 9th with our next episode. So just letting folks know that there's going to be a little bit of a break there. Rachel, thank you so much for being here this week to talk about these two issues.
Thank you, Bill. It's always a pleasure.
And Nate, thanks for being here in studio.
Thanks, Bill.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFD Radio or email AFDradio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from arsenalfordemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on arsenalfordemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.